Mark Twain was a great admirer of the patent system. The country without the patent office, he said, is just a craft and can't travel anyway but sideways and backwards. Fritz Macklin, in a 1952 article, thought it operated on a wholesome illusion. Imitation, he said, always and necessarily lags behind innovation. It would be the best deal from the viewpoint of society if innovators optimistically overestimate this lag. If they expect the lag to be longer than it actually is, innovation will be enhanced and imitation will not be delayed. That it creates this socially wholesome illusion on the part of innovators is the strongest justification for a well-designed patent system. So in other words, a well-designed patent system is something, a system that will fool the inventors. That's what we're looking at. More recently, George Vassala, in his 1988 book on the evolution of technology, reflected that the significance of patent is not that they offer strong and indisputable incentive for invention. The most that can be said is that at some times, or under certain circumstances, patents have probably been beneficial in promoting economic growth and inventiveness. Ideally, a patent is a social contract between the inventor and the public, whereby the inventor reveals his invention and is given in return, for a limited time, the right to prevent others from engaging in the manufacture, use, or selling of the product of the invention. Patents create, for the benefit of inventors, temporary monopoly over their invention by giving them, quote, property rights on invention. This idea of property rights goes back at least as far as Blackstone in the middle of the 18th century, and was elaborated further by French politicians during the French Revolution, eager as they were to avoid the use of the word privilege or monopoly. Now, these property rights of the inventor exclude others and in turn create a tension, a polarization, which has given rise over the history of the patent system here and abroad to a considerable number of arguments for and against the system. It is interesting to notice that arguments in favor of the system have predominated in periods of economic contraction, while arguments against it have had the upper hand in periods of economic expansion. We find ourselves now in a period of recession, and it is therefore natural that calls to strengthen intellectual property rights are being heard in many quarters. The arguments put forward these days to justify the system have less to do with the rights of the inventor to say, as with the fact that investment in research and development need to be protected from pirates and imitators. In an article towards the golden age of technology transfer, in a recent number of Issues in Science and Technology, Alan Treesheim, is the director and CEO of the Argonne National Laboratory, states, without patent protection, no company will invest in the product development and marketing research needed to translate basic technology into practical product. On the other hand, Michael Porter, in his recent book, The Competitive Advantage of Nations, writes, recent attempts to limit competition by beating up intellectual property rights reflect a lack of confidence and a desire to blunt the force of competition. History shows that this is no way to sustain competition, to sustain a competitive advantage. The rapid rate of technological advancement combined with diffusion of technology represent the best combination for productivity growth and sustained economic prosperity. The protection of intellectual property is indeed interlinked with competitiveness. This is one of the key issues of the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. It has been remarked, innovative concepts are becoming as important as goods themselves in international trade. Research firms in industrialized nations are anxious to obtain returns on their investments, while developing countries fear to be kept out of profitable ventures. One major dispute concerns whether intellectual property is granted national treatment, that is, foreigners are given the same treatment with respect to intellectual property as national, or reciprocity, that is, foreigners are given the same treatment as they would have received in their home market. Most developing countries favor national treatment, developed nations favor reciprocity. One of the difficulties is that the agreement on trade and tariffs is passed between nations, while intellectual property is more and more in the hands of multinational corporations. Now, as Robert Reich points out in his article, does corporate nationality matters? The last issue of Science and Technology. It says, in the new global economy, U.S. competitiveness is no longer the same as profitability, productivity, or world market share of American-owned corporations. A better definition of national competitiveness is the capacity of a country's citizen to maintain and enhance their standard of living without bringing to debt to the rest of the world. This goal depends less on the competitiveness of U.S. corporations as it does on the value that the American workforce is able to add to the global economy. And he concludes, U.S. competitiveness policy should not be based on corporation nationality per se, but on corporate behavior. All this seems to call for some kind of globalization of the intellectual property issues and of the patent system. The fundamental question would then appear to be, how can intellectual property be protected in the global economy? But Colin Cleveland, in the June 1989 issue of Change magazine, answers, the question contains the seed of its own confusion. It is the wrong verb, about the wrong noun. And he adds, knowledge is becoming what physical labor, land, minerals, and energy used to be the primary source of power for each person, each organization, each society. Information cannot be owned, only its assembly and delivery system can. Knowledge is not exchanged in a market, but shared in a kind of commons. The mark of commons is that it cannot be readily divided or appropriated, and that it requires an unusual degree of cooperation to be explored or used at all. Since the 1982 reorganization of the federal court system dealing with patents, the notion of intellectual property has been expanded to include life form, mathematical formulation, and even financial tactics. Some, such as U.S. Representative Castaner, worry that society is not well served when protection becomes ubiquitous and pervasive. And Professor Merges, one of our panelists, is quoted by a other panelist, Mr. Andrew, in the New York Times, saying, you could arrive at the point where every idea, every concept, every minor device is somebody's property. The transaction costs of conducting business, or even of just living, would be prohibited. So perhaps, ultimately, the question is less how to protect intellectual property as how to optimize creativity in global information commons. But given the fact that every industrialized country in the West has made patenting a national institution, this question has to be addressed within the framework and the constraints of that institution. In other words, what patent policy should we adopt to ensure our future? To help us approach this question, our panelists will address the issue of patent and patent policy from their own viewpoints. Perhaps the first step is for us to understand the present system of patents and what is involved in getting patents. And Mr. Thomas Penn will be our guide.